නමෝ තස්සේ භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්සේ නමෝ තස්සේ භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්සේ නමෝ තස්සේ භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්සේ. So basically, we were discussing this 64th sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, which is called the Greater Discourse to Malunkya Putta, or in Pali it is called Mahamalunkya Sutta or Mahamalunkya Putta Sutta. So Malunkya Putta is one of the old monks, but seems to be a intellectual person, and he is interested in Dhamma, and several occasions that he has asked various questions from the Buddha, and there is a sutta that ultimately he became an Arahant. Now, at this level, he is still learning, and Buddha is asking various questions, and one question was whether the bhikkhus are available, known to the five lower fetters, what we call as the Aurambhagya Samyojana, five lower fetters. And there are five upper fetters as well, Uddhambhagya Samyojana. So altogether there are 10 Samyojanas, 10 fetters, and those are the ones actually binding us to the whole samsara. And five lower fetters are particularly causing the beings to be bound to the lower realms, like hell realms, human realms, and the heavenly realms. And the upper fetters are particularly causing beings to bound to the low upper realms, like Brahma realms. And so those are the ways that the beings are being bound, so particularly with as a result of the fetters. And the five lower fetters is therefore very much important, because we have to have a thorough understanding about it, and that's why Buddha himself is asking the question from the monks. And at that moment, Malunkyaputta says, "Yes, I know," and he simply named the five lower fetters: Sakkāya Ditthi, Vicikicchā, Sīlabbata Parāmāsa, Kāmarāga, Paṭiga. And that is how he mentioned them. And Buddha asked then, "To whom that I have mentioned five lower fetters like this?" So basically, Buddha was not happy about his answer. And there Buddha mentioned, "If you say like that, even an infant could be considered as who is free from five lower fetters, because these five lower fetters are not yet in an active level in the infant. So if you simply say like this, then someone would say, then in according to your definition, all the infants are free from this, completely free from these five lower fetters." The Buddha highlights there that the infant, even though he doesn't have any sort of identity view, personality view, still the anusaya, the latent tendency of Sakkāya Ditthi, latent tendency of personality view, is available in him. So similarly, he mentioned that the latent tendency of vichikicca, that is the doubt, and latent tendency of Sīlabbata Parāmāsa, that is the rites and attachment to rites and rituals, observances, so that is also with him. And again, the desire, particularly the sensual desire, Kāmarāga, that is also with him. And the Paṭiga, that is the aversion, is also with him. Currently, he may not go through any of this, but the potential is still with him. So later, as he is becoming an elder, so ultimately he end up with all these fetters, and those fetters will come to its active state. So they are at the moment very much like they are sort of seed level, or at the germination. So that point Buddha particularly highlights. And we were discussing one by one the fetters, and we already discussed about the two fetters, that is Sakkāya Ditthi, the personality view, and then the vichikicchā, the doubt. And today we can discuss the other three, the third one. So the third one is called what we call as the Sīlabbata Parāmāsa, attachment to rites and rituals, or adherence to rules and observances. So this is something, an interesting point, because we as spiritual seekers, who the men who are inclined towards some spiritual achievement, are sometimes have to go through certain rituals and observances and all sorts of precepts. So are we also into this trap? So are we adhering to them? Are we attaching to them? Are we holding them, grasping them? Or are we completely free from these fetters? So this is an interesting question. Because we as Buddhists, we think that we are completely free from this fetter, and this fetter is only for the others who may take severe or austere practices, and that we consider as not suitable, and therefore we think that we are completely free from this fetter. But we can say from the kind of practical point of view, so we all are with that fetter till one become a sotapanna, a stream winner. So for example, you as a lay person maybe want to observe five precepts, and as you observe these five precepts, so time to time there may be various doubts whether you have killed an animal or stolen something, engaged with some unsuitable sexual relationship, or whether you have lied to someone or taken any intoxicants. So even with respect to five precepts, there could be various doubts. And again, even if you get into the eight precepts, say during a Poya day, full moon Poya day, observance day, that you may observe maybe eight precepts. At that time also, there could be certain doubts. And if you become anagarika, 10 preceptor, so then with respect to 10 precepts also, there could be various doubts. And particularly when one become a monk, so that monk, particularly at the beginning, could have various doubts about his sila, various doubts about various precepts. So likewise, it is quite natural to have doubts about our sila, whether we have broken or breached any sort of a precept, because our mind is not yet completely purified, not free from this particular fetter. And there may be situations that we sometimes strongly grasp the precepts, strongly grasp the morality, and sometimes we might even neglect them. Now here the grasping side is highlighted, adhering to rules and observances. So that means you are strongly holding. So you believe that it will lead you to purification. So that is where sometimes we go wrong. We might think that there are various rituals, there are various observances, and I have to adhere to them, I have to strictly follow them, and they will take me to the purification. So that's a kind of a view we sometimes have, many people have. So they go through some traditional rituals, they go through certain practices, and that can even lead to self-mortification. And interestingly, this question is asked by the Buddha from Venerable Ananda. There's one interesting sutta. Buddha is asking from Ananda, Ananda, is it proper to say that all the rules and observances, rituals, are taking one to a purification? And then Venerable Ananda give an interesting answer. He says, you can't say it definitely, in definite form. Then Buddha say, okay, then you better elaborate your answer. And there Venerable Ananda give a kind of a distinction between why he has given such an answer. He says, if any kind of a rule and observance, if it is causing to deteriorate one's wholesome qualities, and if it is causing to increase unwholesome qualities, so that observance is not a proper observance. On the other hand, if any kind of a rules, observance, rituals are leading to improve, increase wholesomeness in one's mind and decrease unwholesomeness in one's mind, so that is a proper practice. So the determining factor is our mind, and we have to be in check whether, as a result of this observance, as a result of this practice, as a result of this ritual, whether my wholesomeness of the mind is improving or decreasing. So this is the determining factor. So certain observances therefore may be not suitable, because they might take away the calmness, take away the happiness, or take away the lightness, or even the concentration, even the wisdom, and your eagerness to practice. And certain rituals, observances are in that sense detrimental to the practice. On the other hand, there may be certain other practices which are sort of supportive to the practice. They uplift the mind, they give us a lot of confidence, and they may even attack or sort of helping to decrease the defilements. So like that, certain austere practices are there. Say for example, suppose that you are a monk and you have a strong greediness towards the food, and there are certain austere practices, like you are not taking several meals, you are just trying to satisfy yourself using one meal, or you are simply going on arms round, or you are simply using the bowl without using any other vessels. So likewise, there are certain counteracting measures available as dutangas, as austere practices, so that if you recognize a certain defilement is particularly prominent in yourself, and accordingly you can take those austere practices, so that you are able to tame the mind, you are able to sort of take out the mind from that particular defilement. In that sense, that's a significant value to those austere practices. But on the other hand, say you don't have that kind of attachment towards the food, and you are simply taking whatever is available, and you are not that selective. You are careful about your health, but not going after various delicious food. You are simply taking care of the body, and you have that thorough understanding. In that sense, suppose still that you thought of taking an austere practice, say you are simply eating one meal, or simply using the ball, going on arms round, you have taken that, but it is not assumed that it doesn't give enough nutrition, and you feel tired during the evening, and you don't have enough energy to practice, you don't have enough courage, or you don't have enough nutrition. So likewise, you feel that, okay, now body is deteriorating, you are losing your energy. As a result of that, your mind is not fresh, your mind is not vigilant. So in that sense, the same austere practice is not suitable, because the practice is the important thing, and we need certain amount of energy to continue the practice. So if any kind of this sort of austere practice is taking you to a difficult situation where your ability, the potential to develop certain good wholesome qualities, being hindered, so then better such austere practice to be given up. So likewise, it depends on the circumstance and depends on the person. And if you are taking a certain austere practice or any sort of rituals, any sort of observance, so we have to see whether it is helpful, whether it is supportive to our own practice, and so that it is giving us more productive results, giving us more opportunities to practice wholesomeness and to overcome defilements. So then we can actually follow that rules and regulations, observances, or else we have to discard it. So this is an important part that we all have to remember. And on the other hand, the proper balance, even a proper precept, say for example, as a lay follower, you are taking Panatipata, Veramani, Sikkhapadan, Samadhyam. I am going to refrain from killing any kind of a being. So this is a very important observance, very important precept, But sometimes we might have a lot of doubts about it. Assume that you mistakenly step on an ant, but maybe doubts arise within you after a while, whether you killed it or this or that, and various doubts can arise. So that is completely irrelevant actually, and not necessary. But there could be a possibility that you might end up with various doubts. So that is where actually we have to be careful, and we need to find the balance. And on the other hand, if we completely ignore that observance, if we completely ignore that precept, so that is also not the proper way. So that is where we find we are not respectful, or we are not considerate about the practice. So that is also not something that we have to go through. So we have to have this proper balance. So that balance, how to find that balance? So that is the important thing which is practically necessary to understand. So that actually comes with the meditation practice. Now you know, when you practice meditation, say Anapanasati, you are trying to observe the breathing, for example. So there are, so when you are practicing, so this breathing, at the beginning sometimes forceful breathing, sometimes maybe you are trying to control it. So likewise various issues can happen, and you don't know the proper balance. So as a result of that, what happens is that you may end up with various difficulties, and you can't practice properly because of this imbalance. So you don't know how to maintain the proper balance, the necessary amount of effort, the proper technique, when to stop noting, and all these things are not practically known to you. So as a result of that, it's quite difficult. So therefore, how are we going to have the proper amount, proper energy, necessary amount of effort? So that is actually a kind of a practical point. So as you continue the practice, you come to a point where, okay, you understand yourself, okay, I can simply allow the breathing to happen naturally, and I don't need to interfere, I don't need to do any kind of forceful breathing. So the body knows exactly what is necessary, the right amount, right effort. So the body knows, and body continues it easily. So it's a kind of my responsibility is to simply keep mindful attention there. So that's all. You are not interfering, you are not interrupting the bodily breathing process. You allow quite natural breathing to happen. You step back and make a distance, and then do the proper observation. So that is the kind of a balancing process that we go through, or we learn through the practice. So there is a kind of a process going on, a situation available, but we are not interfering in that. And at the same time, we are not completely distracted from that. Assume that it is necessary to pay attention. So that means we can't completely ignore it. We can't completely distract ourselves. So we have to have necessary amount of attention. At the same time, we should not take too much stance or too much adherence, clinging to it, grasping to it, holding to it, then also we are interfering in the process. So this middle range, so this middle comfortable, say non-frictional area, is something that we need to learn through our own practice. It is valid for every kind of practice. Say you are practicing rising and falling of the abdomen. So there are also sometimes we are interrupting the process. We don't know the necessary amount of energy that we need to maintain. So only after some time through practice you are learning, okay, I can simply allow breathing to happen naturally. Accordingly, rising and falling may naturally evolve. So I am simply step back and watching it. It's kind of effortless, less effort we can say. And I am not interrupting the process. And process is also naturally evolving, continuing, and I am also observing it. I am also not distracted. So similarly, suppose now you are practicing Vipassana, say various sensations are available throughout the body, and you are keeping your attention to each and every sensation, and those sensations are also naturally arising, naturally changing, naturally passing away. And you are not interrupting, you are not trying to push them away, you are not trying to suppress them, and you are not wishing them to come. So you become very unbiased observer. So that mentality. So how, when a process is continuing, how are we going to have that very natural, unbiased attitude to look at it? Not getting distracted and not interfering. So this is a very important, crucial point that we need to learn through our practice. So it's a kind of a trial and error process, because we can't simply teach it through words, but we have to practically learn it through our own practice. So later on, this skill becomes something available for us. So later you understand, okay, there is a possibility. I am not totally distracted and I am not interfering in the process. Process is continuing and I know how to look at it properly. And now I don't feel any tired. Or I don't feel sort of lethargic. So the necessary eagerness or diligence is available in the mind. And the process is also smoothly continuing. I am also not interrupting. And everything happens smoothly. So this is how actually the balancing of, we can say, the balance, the faculties are happening, and this is how the balancing of the enlightened factors are happening at various levels. So we need to find out this proper balance. So Satipatthana practice actually is a key area helping us to develop this skill. So whenever a situation is available, so what is the necessary amount of balance that we need to maintain? It is not that we are interfering in the process. It is not that we are completely distracted, looking outside, we ignore the process, but giving due attention with a balanced mind. So as we continue, assume that you may come to a level where you develop certain amount of thorough understanding about the very process. You understand its impermanent nature, you understand its suffering nature, unsatisfactory nature, and non-governability, you have no control. So these are the insights slowly developing within you, and ultimately as a result of sort of matured insights, suppose that now you are able to give up the whole thing. It is not that you are purposely giving up, rather the mind may naturally release from the process, because nothing to grasp, no point of grasping, no point of holding anything. So the mind naturally get free from everything, get free from all the conditioned phenomena. So this is another important result that the yogi may experience after some time of practice. Now, once you are able to experience such kind of a release, so it's a matter of being there, just be there. So without doing anything, because everything has happened, so your mind being released, so it's a matter of maintaining it. Again, a very subtle balancing is necessary for you to be successful. The moment you become sort of heedless, again the mind go and grasp. The moment that you put unnecessary effort, again mind become restless. So how are we going to have this proper balance at this level? So you can see that at various levels of vipassana, so the balancing has to do by the yogi. So he has to have kind of a introspection, kind of his own understanding about what's going on. He has to do an observation to the mind. And after his proper evaluation, he has to do this balancing, the refinement of the faculties or the enlightenment factors. So that balancing, the refinement, he has to do practically on the way. And as a result of that, now you are able to smoothly even maintain a freed mind, unattached mind, non-grasping mind. So you are able even to maintain. So that's at a little higher level. Now that is where we can say you are learning thoroughly about this non-grasping. So that is where a great influence is now have towards various rules, observances, rituals to everything. All those rituals, all those observances, all those austere practices, So whatever your behavioral aspects that you are maintaining has a great influence coming from your own practice. Practice in the sense, the meditation practice. Because through the meditation you have learned how to maintain the mind without grasping, without interference. And now that learning, so that experience, that skill, you can slowly, automatically apply to rules and regulations as well. And then only you find, okay, what is the balance, what's the comfort area. If you completely neglect precepts, that is also not correct. If you completely grasp, adhere strongly, that is also give a lot of friction to the mind, kind of a burden to the mind. So there only you are finding out the proper balance. So that's why it is highlighted that when one becomes a sotapanna only, one becomes completely free from this fetter, the adherence to rules and rituals. Silabbata paramasa. So this is a very important point Buddha highlights. So those are necessary, we have to use them properly. And at the beginning we don't know the balance. But later as we continue through our meditative practice, and then slowly, slowly, so we learn, we go through various ups and downs, trial and error, and we learn how to look at a particular process non-judgmentally, without interfering and without being distracted, and now you are able to handle it. And that is about the third fetter. So here we have five fetters. Now this is about the third fetter and the fourth fetter. Fourth fetter is called the sensual lust, what we call as the kamaraga. So sensual lust. So how sensual lust arises in the mind? So what are the food? How are we feeding it? So this is also discussed in certain suttas, particularly in the Bojjhanga Samyutta. Buddha mentioned all the five hindrances are having their own supportive conditions. And there are certain food being used to support these hindrances. Without them, they can't sustain. For sensual desire, for the kamachanda, so the particular food is the nimitta, the subanimitta. So various signs, various, say, perceptions, are there which actually give certain trigger to the mind. Suppose that you are looking at a girl. Say as a young guy, suppose that one see a girl, beautiful girl. And there you are looking at certain features. So there are certain already hardwired, deeply coded interest within the mind. And accordingly you try to find out certain features. Maybe the figure, maybe the color, maybe the hair, maybe the eyes, whatever it is. So these are what we call as a subanimitta. So that those certain signs, marks available, so that our lust is basically being triggered. Lust is basically being now increasing. Previously there was no lust, but as a result of these subanimittas, various signs, now this unarisen lust is now arising. An arisen lust slowly growing. Because you are more and more taking these subanimitta. You are more and more taking these various signs, figures, marks, and it is promoting lust further and further in the mind. So Buddha mentioned these nimittas. Subanimittas are the main cause to trigger lust in the mind. You can check whether you are able to arouse lust in you without having any of the subanimittas. You can try that. So basically you can, so this nimitikaranaya, what we call as the making signs or grabbing those signs, is one essential action of three defilements, raga, dosa, moha. Rāgu kvāvso nimitta karano, dōso nimitta karano, mōho nimitta karano. So in the Mahavedala Sutta, Venerable Sāriputta mentioned, so that these three roots, unwholesome roots, are completely responsible for this nimittikarane, for this objectification, we can say. So various signs we are picking up for that whole process. What kind of sign we are picking up? What kind of sign to which that we are interested of? So that totally depends on the lust, hatred and delusion available in the mind. So if we are taking it more and more, lust, hatred, delusion are further growing. You are feeding it. So it has a kind of a cycle. So lust, hatred, delusion are responsible for picking up various signs. And as we continue that process, it is kind of self-promoting lust, hatred and delusion. Now it is growing. And ultimately the mind gets overwhelmed by lust. So the similar thing Buddha mentioned about the patiga as well. That means the aversion or hatred in the mind. So there are also various signs are there. Say for example, there is someone that you don't like. So when you look at him, so what are the signs that you are looking at? Whether the way that he walks, whether the way he talk, whether the way he behave, whether the way he looking at something. So there are certain points that we don't like, we don't appreciate, we can't accept it. We simply say it is, say, not proper. So I am now picking up those improper things, but as a result of that, the hatred, aversion is growing in the mind. So that itself is causing to pick me those different patiga nimitta, the causes, the various signs available in that particular person. Now it is causing to further increase the anger within the mind. Patiga nimitta. So in the lust, we are using the subha nimitta. For the hatred, we are using the patiga nimitta. So therefore, these nimittas, these various signs, features, characteristics, figures, all these are playing a crucial role in sort of promoting defilements in one's mind. So nimitti karane. So there's a significant value in there. And the interesting point is, now suppose there is a same object. Now suppose there is a girl. And how this girl being looked at by three different people. Say a young person, a matured person, an old person. The same girl. The young person may be quite interested and he is looking at various features, figure and everything, blah blah blah. So as a result of that, he is increasing lust. Maybe a kind of a matured person, he might think about her as she is very much like my daughter and might have kind of a parental love towards her. So that's another situation. And maybe a very elderly old person might feel her like my granddaughter and have another way of looking at her. So same thing, but depending on our own mentality, the how we are looking at it, how we are picking up various signs and what are the defilements arise in our mind is completely different. So lust, hatred and delusion, raga, dosa, moha are the responsible causes influencing this whole process. And once we pick those signs, we do inner fabrications. We know how to do the further multiplications, subtractions, divisions, additions, fabrications that our mind will take care. Do all the kind of fabrications and ultimately we end up with either lust, hatred, delusion, everything is there. So this is how the sankharas are coming to the picture. So therefore understanding this, the nature, how lust is arising, how hatred is arising in one's mind is very, very important. So that is, we can say, one part of the practice. So as you continue Chittanupassana, Dhammanupassana, so this becomes very important. So you start looking at your own mind. So at the beginning, it might be difficult because if we try to do it, we get deluded by them. Because the signs and these various thoughts are quite deluding, quite delusive, quite tempting. So as a result of that, we get caught up with that very process. And we start ultimately thinking too much about it and ultimately we end up with developing further defilements. So So the first stage is to develop certain necessary skills through Kaya Anupassana, through Vedana Anupassana, so that we have that ability to look at the mind properly. Whenever lustful thought arises, okay, this is a mere lustful thought. Whenever anger arises, okay, this is mere anger. So likewise, you should be able to separate anger, lust, and you should be able to step back and watch it objectively. So that skill takes time to develop. So that is possible to develop through Kaya Anupassana without much difficulty, without much confusion. And as a result of that, later you are able to look at the mind through the mind. Because previously we are looking at the body through the mind. Now we are, as a result of the developed skills, now we are able to look at the mind through the mind. So that is where we have to have that the kind of progressive pattern stages in the practice. Now once we have it, then we can do a proper practice where various defilements are arising. Now you can step back and watch it. Another defilement arising, you can step back and watch it. You are not being carried away by that defilement. You are not going to implement that defilement. Rather, you can simply let it go. So likewise, in Satipatthana, Buddha mentioned with respect to lust, with respect to hatred. So this sort of a practice, what we call saragan chittanti pajanati. Sadosan chittan, sadosan chittanti pajanati. So when there is a lustful thought arising in the mind, yes, there is lustful thought arising in the mind. When there is hateful thought available in the mind, so you know, okay, there is a hateful thought available in the mind. From that point onwards, you are not feeding it. You are not sort of deluded by that. You did that separation. Previously, you somehow fed it to some extent because of lack of mindfulness, weakness of the, say, weak mindfulness. But later, you are able to establish mindfulness. So once the mindfulness is established, you are able to step back. Now you can look at it objectively. As a result of that, you stop feeding it. You are not strengthening it. Now you can stop. So as a result of that, naturally, that recent defilement may slowly fade away. The same process we have to do for hate as well. So previously, we can't do it because we don't have enough mindfulness. So sometimes hate may overwhelm the mind, anger may overwhelm the mind, we start being angry, we start arguing with another person, we start blaming another person, we start getting into quarrels with other persons, because we don't have any control. But as we continue the practice, we can stop at least that, what we call the transgression part, vitikkama kilesa, where even though internally you are sort of burning with anger, you are not going to argue with the other person. You are not going to react. You are not going to get into any quarrel with the other person. But still you are internally burning with anger. That is another stage. But as you further continue, you become less burning. Previously your burning was quite intense. But now it is less burning. And of course, you are not going to react. You are not going to argue. You are not going to blame. You are not going to hit, quarrel. That is also not there. And as you further continue, that burning become even less. And maybe even the first thought of anger, you may be able to trace. So that is what mentioned in the Dhammanupassana. Buddha mentioned, even the first thought, you are able to trace. Anupannasa Vyapadasa Upado Hoti Tancha Pajanati. So previously there is no anger at all in the mind. The mind is in a calm, relaxed, peaceful state. But due to some cause, now anger arising, even that very initial stage you are able to trace. Initial stage you are able to recognize. As a result of that, you do this separation. So the moment that you are able to recognize, you do this separation. And this anger become very much redundant. You have no supportive conditions for that. As a result of that, it will fade away. So this is the typical process that we have to go through in order to overcome lust, hatred, with respect to Satipatthana, but there are other means before that. Say you can practice Asubha Bhavana, you can practice Metta Bhavana to counteract lust and hatred. That is at the beginning maybe of your practice, because the Satipatthana development will take some time. You can't have immediate thorough understanding of Vipassana. So this Asubha Bhavana and the Metta Bhavana are quite useful at your early stages, particularly to overcome, to maintain the mind at the middle level. But later, as you are very much equipped with mindfulness, you have thorough understanding about mindfulness and you have your hands-on experience, the moment you are able to make the separation, the moment you establish mindfulness, that defilement can't stay. It will slowly fade away. It will become sort of blurred, slowly disappear, because your establishment of mindfulness is so powerful. And actually in this sutta, Buddha takes a different approach to explain the overcoming of defilements, so that we can discuss later, maybe next time. So basically what Buddha highlights here at its first stage is about these five fetters, where the yogi is not yet capable of overcoming it. So say for example, here Buddha mentioned the untaught ordinary person who has no regard for noble ones and is unskilled and undisciplined in their dhamma, who has no regard for the true men and is unskilled and undisciplined in their dhamma, abides with the mind obsessed and enslaved by identity view. And similarly, he explained obsessed and enslaved by the what we call the rules and adherences, obsessed and enslaved by doubt, obsessed and enslaved by ill will and sensual lust. So there he don't know how to escape from them. He does not understand as it actually is, the escape from a recent ill will. And when that ill will has become habitual and is uneradicated in him, it is a lower fetter. So that means we are feeding them. So various fetters are arising and we don't know how to overcome them. We don't know how to escape from them. So we are promoting them. We are feeding them. And ultimately it becomes fairly sort of concrete. It becomes fairly established within the deep levels of the mind. And now it is a fetter. Now it is what we call as a tendency, a latent tendency, anusaya or asava we can call. Now it is very difficult to remove it because everything was quite sedimented. Everything has gone to the deep levels of the mind. So those are the sort of anusaya, the latent tendencies that we have to somehow uproot. So that is where the Buddha's teaching is quite important. Not mere suppressing of the defilements, but even to recognize these deeply rooted tendencies available in the mind and slowly abandoning them, slowly uprooting them. So that is why the practice may become quite long or will take time, because this eradication, this uprooting of latent tendencies is not something very fast. It will take time. Okay, I think that is enough for today's sutta teaching session. Now I like to invite the participants to ask if they have any questions. You can participate in the discussion. Have anything? Yeah. Okay, we have a question from our side.
Sadhu, 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 Bhante. Thank you for explaining this sutta and most amazing deep dhamma the Buddha is teaching us. When you are speaking of greed, hate, and delusion, excuse me, I see here that the five lower fetters include sensual desire and ill will. So those two would be lust, sensual desire would fall under lust particularly, and hatred would fall under ill will particularly. But then there's delusion, which you're speaking of the signs of hate, greed, and delusion. We see these signs that cause sensual desire and the signs that cause our hatred to arise, or that trigger our hatred, let's say. And then it's interesting that you were talking about delusion too, but then I was really curious to hear what are the signs for delusion? Like, what are those things that trigger a delusion? And then another thing is that how does delusion feed ill will? How does delusion feed sensual desire? And, like, how does sensual desire feed delusion?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm really curious about how those interact,
mm-hmm.
as together, because I get the feeling that they're all connected. They're almost maybe the same thing.
Mm.
Could you speak about
that? Yeah. They are all well connected. So basically, delusion is a kind of a pervaded defilement. It's everywhere. Now, when you can't have lust without delusion, because you have to objectify she's a woman, she's a beautiful girl.
Okay.
So that I am a person, I am a man, and she's a woman.
Mm-hmm.
So that very, very identification is due to delusion. So you distinct. And you make a person, you become someone, and you become a man, and and that object becomes she, and she's a beautiful woman. So that very objectification happens due to our own delusion, avijja. So that fabrication happens due to delusion, avijja paccha sankhara, sankhara paccha vijnana. So that continuation happened, the very root cause is the avijja, the not knowing. Basically, we are living in a society, so that individuation is very much highlighted. So you are an individual, I am an individual, say I have my own identity, I have my own passport, I have my own name and nationality and blah blah blah, mm-hmm. and you also have this and that, mm-hmm. and I am a man, she's a woman, so likewise that the diversification, that mm-hmm. kind of a distinction is well established in the society. So the moment I see a woman, so I recognize her as a woman.
Yes.
So then the latent tendencies are operating within the mind. Oh, she's a beautiful woman. I better ask her name. I better ask her address and whatever it is.
Yeah. So it's a sort of confusion about what is, like, that I am something different than you.
Mm.
So
immediately when a sign appears in the mind,
yes.
so immediately we attach a label to it, immediately I attach a person to it.
Yes.
We can't simply look at it as a sign. Say, when I'm looking at something through the eye,
yeah.
so what is immediately arising in the retina is simply a sign.
Yeah.
But I didn't figure it out. What I do is, this is a beautiful cup. Oh, this is a beautiful clock.
Okay, we start to perceive
Perceive yes. it from the object point of view.
Okay.
We make it kind of a subjective experience. So I have my own gathered information. I have my gathered all prejudices and all different kinds of perceptions. So to this particular sign, I attach all these things very quickly,
yes.
and that is how I recognize it.
Would you say that is delusion?
Definitely.
That's like a definition of delusion.
No, not... I can't say it's definition.
I'm wondering, what is it? Exactly?
That's the thing. So that's why, I mean, it's very difficult to detach delusion from anything. So the delusion is everywhere. Delusion is pervading the whole experience.
Okay.
So either you recognize a person and you get angry, that is also due to delusion. When you recognize a person and you become lustful, that is also, there's a delusion involved. So now how about assume, now you are developing vipassana and you thoroughly do a proper analysis, proper investigation. And again and again you get a thorough understanding, okay, there is no person here. No? There is no being here. Everything is very much like interacting and these are mere processes, elements, characteristics, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So likewise, so you... slowly, slowly disintegrate this whole process. Now you can't recognize a person within you. You can't recognize an individual within you, a man within you. And you recognize, okay, a man is a convention. A woman is a convention.
Yes.
A girl is a convention. A boy is a convention. And okay. Now you are slowly, you know, sort of unentangle the whole process.
Mm-hmm.
You are recognizing where you have went wrong. You keep convention as convention. You are not taking convention as something true, something, say, hard or something concrete. You simply say, okay, this is a mere convention.
Yes.
Other than the convention, there is nothing substantial there.
Yes.
So that's a very, you know, very kind of a thorough understanding. Now say, if I am telling this clock.
Yeah.
So this clock consists of many things. It has a battery. It has some circuit, it has some representation, it has some plastic, and all things are assembled together.
Okay.
Now I call it as a clock, an alarm clock, a Seiko alarm clock. Now I am adding a brand name even to that.
Yeah.
So now all that complications, all that fabrications, if I am able to recognize how this clock being created,
mm-hmm.
how these all fabrications are properly, you know, assimilated, properly aligned, assembled, and then I give a name as Seiko alarm clock.
Yes.
So there are, now I have a kind of an understanding, okay, there is no real clock available here. It's a kind of assembly of so many little parts. There is no substantial clock available here. So if I have that thorough understanding within me,
yeah.
I can still look at the time.
Okay.
But I may not so much attach to it, I may not so much grasp it, because I know there is nothing called a clock, it is a mere name.
Yeah.
The clock is basically an assembly of so many little instruments, little parts.
Yeah.
So likewise, so when we are able to penetrate that compactness available, so that is very important insight.
Yes.
So all vipassana process is actually attacking that delusion. So that's why, so the delusion is available for everywhere, available for each and every defilement. You can't have any defilement without delusion. So the overcoming delusion is also a tedious process, a long process that we are continuing with our vipassana, and that is responsible slowly to attack at various levels, various hinges where the delusion is operating. Maybe the compactness. As a result of compactness view, we immediately attribute a person to it, an object to it.
Mm-hmm.
And when we see something continuously, so we think, oh, it exists. That's also due to delusion.
Yeah.
Now say, for example, this light. And you know, this is not a continuous light. It's always blinking. That blinking we can't recognize. It's a rising and passing away. On and off, we can't recognize. Our eye is not capable of, it's not that sensitive to recognize that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a continuous process is going on.
Yeah.
So likewise, so more you thoroughly understand through vipassana the whole process, so the delusion become less and less, avijja become less and less, ignorance become less and less. As a result of that, the fabrication become less and less. Avijja, paccaya, sankhara, now you do the opposite. That when the absence of avijja, when the ignorance is not available, so the mind become calm, mind become relaxed, mind stop doing fabrications. As a result of that, that whole process now slowly, slowly stopped. So your mind is peaceful. Even though you look at something, I just called it as something,
yes.
Now you are not fabricating. So mind stopped fabrication. Now the same girl, conventionally you probably recognize, okay, she's a girl, but you don't need to think too much about her because there is no real her there.
Yeah.
Just maybe you can, if there is lust available, you can do a kind of a little vipassana and disintegrate the whole thing, and later you may be able to look at her, but no defilements, no thoughts even in the mind, because mind prefers to be alone, mind prefers to be dispassionate. And mind prefers to be sort of released rather than getting involved. So likewise, the Vipassana process is helping us to overcome this whole delusion. So to answer your question, so I can't give a simple answer, okay, this is the only cause causing delusion. There are many causes.
Yeah.
And Buddha, in summary, Buddha mentioned the delusion is the not knowing of the Four Noble Truths.
Yes. I just was remembering that when you were speaking. Okay. That completely answers.
Yeah.
Thank you, Bhante.
Are there any more questions?
Anything? No, not from our side.
Then I'd like to invite Ramika to ask the next question.
Yeah, Teruvan Sannai.
Too, isn't it? But once we understand this is my attachment, this is my anger, then that delusion goes away, isn't it? But that is what I felt. So
yeah, that is, I mean, to some extent you are correct. So basically, recognizing attachment as attachment, delusion as delusion, or say anger as anger. So that is one important aspect. So you are able to look at it objectively. It is not my anger. It is mere anger. It is not my lust. It is mere lust. So you do that separation. So it's a kind of a causal result. A reason in the mind due to certain causes, and you are able to look at it. Okay, this is this. But you need to correct that it is not my anger. It is not my lust, but it is just anger, it is just lust. And you are able to do that separation. At that moment, you are not further feeding it, encouraging it. So as a result of that, there is a higher possibility you are able to overcome that. Definitely. No, that's the thing. We can't say that we are completely enlightened even there, because the potential, the latent tendencies are still available. So that's why that's the Buddha's main point he highlights. So even though currently there are no active defilements in the mind, that doesn't guarantee in the future that I am completely free from that particular defilement. Still, the potential could be available. Due to various reasons, again the same defilement can arise. So that's why we have to be quite vigilant in our practice, continue our practice till complete uprooting of defilements happen. That's why the practice becomes a bit difficult. Otherwise, I mean, if you suppose that you are able to develop certain concentration, as a result of that, all the defilements are not existing right now. So temporarily you are liberated, but not permanently. Again, the next moment when the necessary amount of concentration is not available, or necessary amount of wisdom is not available, again mind go and grasp. Again you get deluded.
Thank you.
So that's why I mean ultimate, from the ultimate sense, so Buddha mentioned Nibbana as Ragakkayo, dosakkayo, mohakkayo. So when you are to thoroughly or 100% attain Nibbana, so that means complete uprooting of raga, dosa, moha. So till that time to time, even a noble person might end up with various, entangled with various fetters.
Okay. what we do, you know, identify that it is really getting reduced in me, you less and less involved with this defilement?
So that's a very interesting question. Yeah, that is through our own observation of our own mind. Say, for example, previously, say about 6 months ago, if you consider your mind, how many frequent lustful thoughts arise in your mind? How many frequent hateful thoughts arise in your mind? How much too much thinking happen in your mind? You have a little bit of an assessment about it. And today, what is the amount of that? Are you feeling kind of a reduction in it? Are you feeling kind of a calmness in your mind comparatively with just before 6 months ago with respect to that time and today? What is the difference? Are you feeling any kind of a reduction of lust, hatred, delusion? So then we can say, okay, there's a little reduction, yes. Okay, and there's a calming down. My mind is a little peaceful now. Less burning. Not too much talking. Not too much inner chatter. So likewise, it's a very, you know, relatively that we need to look at. As a result of the practice, is there a little reduction happen in the mind? So from the day yesterday to today, there may not be difficult to recognize that kind of a reduction. But when we are considering a considerable period of time, so there may be a little reduction one can recognize. Then there's a slow fading off happens. Mm-hmm.
Means things go through that. Things doesn't hold on to that. You know, it's just it's water is falling out of the sponge and it goes through.
Mm-hmm.
When somebody is very bad situation, also I feel it shouldn't be sad. You know,
mm-hmm.
And I don't not like. Those days, if somebody is died or something, then I would say, my deepest sympathies. But I don't feel like saying that word.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I feel it's useless word. You know, deepest sympathies or that person attaining nirvana, it is useless. You know,
mm-hmm.
to say that. So if I don't say, also people think, oh, this person is so, you know. Arrogant or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I can, you know, people can think like that, you know, but I'm not worried about that. But, you know, it's like that. Even when the happiness comes in, those days I would say, oh, congratulations and blah, 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 and go on praising that person. But now I don't feel like praising that person too.
Mm-hmm.
Because then I really feel that whether I am so arrogant again. So
mm-hmm.
I cannot be happy with that person's happiness. But I mean, in my heart of heart, I feel that there's nothing to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
So will that be a problem in
society? No. Actually, basically, it is not a problem. Basically, this is how the practice evolves. So our amplitude of that oscillation become less and less. Now, typically, our mind oscillates. So when something good happens, so our mind oscillates to a very higher level and we get elated. And when something bad happens, then it goes to the other side, to the negative side, and again we become completely collapsed. So that is how we were operating. But as a result of the practice, that oscillation become less and less. That amplitude become less and less. So you are very much associating the bottom, the middle line. So you are becoming more and more steady, less oscillations. So you are simply maintaining that less oscillation and kind of a comfort zone. It is not kind of an insensitivity. you are quite sensitive, but you the mind's shock absorbers will reduce that shock.
Yeah, sometimes I feel that I'm having too much conditioned my mind to this kind of situation, or I feel that, you know, am I made it conditioned.
Mm. No, on the other hand, you can see if mind is conditioned or whether the mind is more deconditioned. Previously, mind was so much conditioned. I am so and so, I should be like this, I should be like that, I should cry, I should laugh, I should get elated, I should react. All these shoulds are there, shouldn'ts are there. Now you, as a result of the practice, you become more natural. So, as much as possible, your mind become more natural, more into its normal, natural, original state. That conditioning has become less and less. As a result of that, you can cope up with any situation. Because you understand through the practice, okay, there is nothing substantial here. Nothing to take so serious about it. Everything is transient, everything is changing. You can't have permanent happiness. And there is no person, an individual in the ultimate sense. So likewise, that those understandings, those insights are really giving us a thorough establishment, thorough understanding, deeper stability to the mind, so that the typical ups and downs of the life is not taking too much stance, not taking too much penetrative influence to the mind. Mind has thoroughly understood some deeper insights.
Thank you, Mantu.
Yeah, Thiruvan Sannai.
Discuss these things. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to invite Yasala for the next question.
Thank you, Jennifer. Thank you, Bhante, for the Dhamma talk today. Actually, in the Dhamma talk, you mentioned like to see the thought coming in, so that the seeing itself will some kind of, you know, discourage. I actually thinking of like sharing example, Bhante. Like these days, I actually had some, I would say, lustful thoughts coming in. But then somehow, yes, as you mentioned, I could see that. So I see that there's a lustful thought coming. And as you mentioned, I did not do any further on that. So yeah, I saw that and somehow it stopped there. And then, so it happened not only once, few times, especially like when I become free, when I'm not busy physically. I can see these thoughts coming, and I was just looking at it. But then the thing is that it keeps coming. But I feel like me being lucky in that sense that I can notice it now. I think that's because of the practice. So, Bhante, I think this is how it. This is also kind of a stage, right? So I keep on doing the practice more and more, and that might help me eventually to even. I think, yeah, maybe even not to have this last two thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I can agree with you. Basically, when we are fairly aware of the mind, so we can recognize lustful thoughts. Previously, actually, we were unable to do that. What happened was, we become slaves to lustful thoughts. Immediately, we start reacting according to it, and we get deluded by them, and we start doing various this and that, because we become a victim of the lustful thought. But now we are able to trace them, we are able to notice them. So, okay, they are lustful thoughts. They are still available, they are still coming. But I am not promoting it, I am not encouraging them, but they are still coming. So, that's all right, as far as we can say. Because in one sense, what we can understand is the tendency is still available in the mind. The lustful tendency, the raga anusaya is still available. So that is why a little bit of maybe grabbing of those little signs are still happening because the tendency is available. Assume that someday, one day, that if that is completely eradicated, uprooted, then these lustful thoughts may completely disappear because the root is not available. The essence is not available. The necessary causes are not available. And it will simply very much, those type of thoughts may not arise in the mind. So that's why Buddha sometimes mentioned to evaluate our practice, to see the fading away of lust. By recognizing how many lustful thoughts are arising, what is their whether they are intense or whether they are reducing, because as a result of the practice, it has to fade away slowly. By the way, I mean, we can't say that immediately lust will disappear. It may not happen, but slowly it will fade away.
Because previously, in a similar thought, definitely a following action would have happened.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
Correct, correct. Yeah, that's why, you can see that it's a kind of a tedious process because there's a significant tendency in the mind to promote it even because it has some sort of a delight, particularly in the lustful thought. So we have to restrain ourselves, we have to have certain amount of dedication to the practice, we have to have a kind of a very good restrainment in the mind. Okay, I should not promote this. I need to let it go. This time I am not, whenever a lustful thought is arising, okay, I am not going to play with it. I am not allowing it to completely overwhelm the mind. I simply let it go. So that's a very good restrainment that we need to maintain, a good wisdom we have to maintain.
Thank you, Bhante.
Yeah, yeah. Yes.
I have a question and also to add something to what that other lady was talking about, how she does not feel, either sorrow or joy or what, she doesn't know what to say.
Mm-hmm.
I am experiencing a similar thing, but I just still go ahead and say what is necessary to observe the norms of society. I also have that same thing when somebody, I don't feel this great big sorrow and great big joy.
Mm-hmm.
But I just still go ahead and say those. Is that all right? I'm not lying, but it's sort of like a expectation, like saying hello to somebody or something like that.
Yeah.
That's okay, right?
I also think, because it is not that... we want to cheat another person, but we are simply respecting the tradition or simply just maintaining an unfriction path, simply greeting another person, say hello or something like that. But still, we need to maintain the mind's calmness, peacefulness without disturbing it.
Right. One other thing is, Malte, I do observe my mind quite a lot. Especially when I'm sitting in Pranayama meditation and all that, I observe my mind, but during day-to-day stuff also, I catch myself many times. But there are situations when I feel that if I get too close to the situation, it is upsetting for me and I just don't get there. So what should I be doing in situations like that? Like, for instance, there is a certain individual that I dislike being around. So what do I do with them? I know that I'm feeling like that, but I'm not the only one who feels that way. There are others too, but I just... But there's also Buddha says, Aksevana Chapalana. So how do I handle this, Bhante?
Yeah, I think two things. So basically, when we are not yet confident about our own practice, so we have to be quite careful. because this association, as you said, can have an influence towards my practice. So assume that he is not a good person and he is promoting something bad, and as a result of this association, I also become a bad person. I also become sort of tempt to do what he is doing. So that sort of thing can happen. So that's why Buddha was cautious about it. He asked, okay, you need to avoid them, avoid those bad people. So that is something we need to accept, we need to adhere to. On the other hand, another level is where you are developed to a fair level. So you yourself is quite established in your practice. So you are now thorough, you are now strong, and you can establish yourself every time as much as possible within your good stance. In that sense, the other person can't have much influence on you.
Mm-hmm.
That is also mentioned. So there are, you become kind of a stronger person. The other person is very much, even though he's a bad person, he can't have a significant influence in you because you are well established. So that is another level.
Bhante, I will never be influenced by that individual to become like him. It's just that being in the presence itself is upsetting me.
Mm-mm. Yes.
How do I control those thoughts in me? So I just avoid it.
That's the easiest thing to avoid. Not meeting
that's
him.
That's okay, right?
Yeah,
it
it's
is
okay.
Also, I'm feeling it is some kind of fatigue.
I don't say it is a patiga. It's a kind of a strategy, we can say. Say there's a person that, assume that there are two shops available. In one shop, that you are properly greeted and you are being treated properly and you are sort of giving the necessary things properly. And there's another shop, they are not greeting you well, they are hating you and they are blaming you and all things. So you avoid that one. So you go to this good shop.
So then you acknowledge that the strategy that I am employing is okay.
Yeah, I think it's okay.
Yeah.
No problem. But the thing is, there may be situations we can't avoid. That is where we have to be careful. Because now when we have a selection, yes, I can select what is suitable, what is kind of helpful to me, useful to me. But there may be other situations that I have no say, I have no selection, I have to bear it. So at that time I have to be cautious not to get influenced by the other person's wrong, unwholesome activities, to maintain my wholesomeness intact.
Okay, thank you. By the way, another thing, a little question. I was listening to one of your Sinhala Dharma talks and you were mentioning in order to keep your mind from, getting attracted by all kinds of things that are prevalent in the world. Best is not to get in, you were also talking about watching TV and YouTube. I do watch a lot of YouTube, otherwise I cannot follow the Dhamma. You're talking about other things, right?
Yeah. Because people are not only looking at YouTube to learn Dhamma, no? So there are many things available in the YouTube. So they get distracted, they get addicted to that. They spend a lot of time in watching YouTube, maybe films and this and that. So that is what I was pointing out.
Thank you, Bhante. We appreciate your teachings. Much merit to you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Bhante, there's actually a written question.
Right.
It says, one should feel mudita when another person is successful.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. Nice and simple answer, huh?
So that is the quality of mudita. Yes, that is the quality of mudita. So typically what happens is, when another person is successful, there's a tendency in our mind to be jealous, envious. But the quality, the good quality to have is the mudita, where when we see someone is successful, to appreciate that, to encourage that and to be happy about his own success. So that is something Buddha appreciated, Buddha recognized and asked us to develop instead of jealousy or envy. So we have to have the mudita.
Okay, thank you, Bhante. And then I'd like to invite Chita Devi for the next question.
Yes, thank you, Jennifer. Just touching on that mudita, Bhante, that is also something that those two ladies said, that they don't feel happiness when somebody is happy. But that thought crossed me, because the Buddha encouraged us to have mudita, so it's okay to feel joy in other people's
success,
success or happiness or whatever, without attachment. So that should be okay, isn't it?
Yes,
Bhante?
Yes. So actually, I was pointing out it is that typically we take these things too much, and we laugh, we clap, and we drink, and all these things that people do, that typical celebrations. So that is not that may completely usually fade away, and you become little happy about it. You become appreciating about that his achievement. It also may happen honestly, not that you are showing it. It may happen honestly, and you are happy about it. You have the mudita about it, but you are not going to throw a party to that or something like that. That may be stopped now.
The other point I was going to clarify with you was that the avijja and the delusion, ignorance and delusion, are they similar? Or I mean, the delusion part sort of overlaps with the avijja. So you answered that first question by saying that the Buddha said delusion was the not understand the Four Noble Truths.
No, that is typical the avijja. I think the avijja is where Buddha mentioned not knowing of the Four Noble Truths. Delusion, that is how typically it is mentioned. Delusion, the moha, is also where, say, we are attributing a self, where there is no self, and we are attributing a permanence where there is no permanence. So likewise, so it's, that's why I mean, these things are fairly interrelated as far as I can see.
Yes, because they are in you can use the same word for similar situations. Would
yes.
that be right?
I think so, yes.
Because delusion also is a kind of not knowing, no? And avijja
correct.
Also is not realizing.
Correct.
Isn't that right?
Correct. Yes.
So, but for clarification, you say delusion is not knowing the anicca dukkha anatta. Would that be right?
We can say like that. Yes, that's why I mean it is not single thing. Many things are there. Say one can say delusion is where you can't understand anicca dukkha anatta. Delusion is where you can't understand the paticca samuppada. So likewise, at many levels we can define, this is also delusion, this is also delusion, this is also delusion. So that is why in the vipassana we are introducing many vipassana knowledges, many levels of understandings to cut off that different levels of delusion.
Yes. And avijja is more associating a self, right?
Yeah, that is one important thing. That is, we recognize our situation as a self, as a person, as an individual. So that is happening because of the avijja. So as a result of the practice, when we are able to penetrate that, once we understand non-self, so that significantly reduced delusion.
Delusion now or
avijja? No, that's the thing.
Or both?
That's the thing. I mean, there may be subtle differences there, but I would say they are interrelated.
Yeah, yeah, because avijja paccha sankara, sankara paccha vinyana, vinyana paccha nama rupa.
Yes, yes.
So if you lose that avijja, then you lose the sense of self, isn't it?
Correct, definitely, definitely.
But yeah, sometimes I used to think, well, you can't quite define those two clearly. I mean, they are one and the same sometimes. Sometimes they overlap. Would you agree with me?
Yes, yes. That's why difficult. It's difficult to have a clear mark. What is exactly delusion? How it is different from avijja? It's difficult I can say that how we are sort of differentiate it. I need to check it. Certain places there may be someone might have recognized it. I need to find it out. But from the practice point of view, they are quite interrelated.
Yes, yes. Yeah, that's what I wanted, a clarification. But I think that as you say, they are intertwined and overlap. And
exactly.
Sometimes they're one and the same, I think.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Yes.
That's fine. Yeah.
Yes, yes, yes.
Because Buddha hasn't quite defined the two independently. Would that be right if I said that?
I also can say, that's why I want to check, as far as I can remember,
yes.
I didn't come across any particular sutta where Buddha separately defined these two. What is moha and what is avijja, what is the difference between these two? I can't remember such sutta where Buddha is differentiating these two.
Anyway, if you do, we would like you to mention it, Bhante.
Sure. I'll see. Teaching. I'll see whether...
Yes.
Such sutta or such information is available somewhere.
Yeah, okay, right. Thank you, Bhante. It's just for completeness sake,
I think.
And, it's nice to know.
Correct,
thank
correct.
You.
Yes, yes.
So, Nancy, can I ask a follow-up to
mm-hmm.
that? This is something I think I was thinking earlier when I asked that, is that in meditation there's neutral feeling, there's pleasurable feeling, and there's... non-pleasurable feeling,
mm-hmm.
And the neutral feeling
mm-hmm.
is delusion. It's related to delusion, right?
Mm-hmm.
Would that add to this sort of question?
No, thing is, with respect to neutral feeling, what is the counterpart of the neutral feeling is the delusion. And that is also not delusion, that is also mentioned avijja.
Okay.
Yeah, in the Chula Vedala Sutta, so when it is asked, what is the counterpart? Patibhaga of Upekkha. So this venerable mention, it is the avijja.
That's ignorance. So they're interacting, neutral feeling.
No, thing is, they are actually when neutral feeling is available, you don't know about it. You don't notice it. So that is why it is promoting some sort of an avijja.
Okay.
That is why.
Seems like that would be a key aspect of how we become ignorant. It's this neutrality of
when you go through a kind of happiness, you could easily notice it.
Okay.
When you go through some suffering, pain, you could easily notice it.
Yeah.
But when you are going through some neutral feelings, you're quickly ignorant about it, and you don't have much about it, and you don't notice it, you feel bored about it.
Okay.
So there's a significant influence, therefore coming towards avijja, because you don't notice it. And here the question, adukkama sukhaya paneya vedanaya king patibhagoti. Now this is the question. When you consider the neutral feeling, what is the counterpart of it? Adukkama sukhaya ko also visaka vedanaya avijja patibhagoti. So this Venerable Dhammadinna answering to this neutral feeling, the counterpart is the avijja, the not knowing part. So therefore, I feel they are quite interrelated. Avijja and Moha are quite interrelated. Mm-hmm. May be synonyms.
Yeah, I think they are.
Yeah.
I think I've heard that they are
synonyms.
Same.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the thing.
Just it's in English, two different words.
Yeah.
Used
yeah.
for the same thing.
Correct. Now, say for example, now when we call tanha. Many terms are there for tanha. We call it lobha, we call it lust, we call it raga, and tanha, kamaraga. So many, many terms are there. But some same qualities also there, but there's a little subtle nuances are also there. So maybe in avijja and moha, that's what I need to see whether such little differences are there. I can't remember. I need to find it out.
Okay.
Yeah.
Buddha highlights the self-attachment in avijja.
Avijja, self-attachment.
Yeah.
Many things are there, not only self-attachment. That's why not knowing Four Noble Truths is significantly mentioned at many places as avijja. And say not knowing impermanence, not knowing unsatisfactoriness or non-self, that is also a part of avijja. So likewise, think they are fairly interrelated.
Incorrect understand.
Incorrect understanding, that's also there. So sometimes it is mentioned avijja is of two forms, that you don't know, that is one type. The other sign is you know but it is wrong. Incorrect understanding. So that even though you think that you know, if your understanding is wrong, it's a wrong view, that is also avijja. So likewise, it's it is good that we are talking about them, we differentiate about it, it's really good for our understanding, but it's a kind of a deep subject, and there are moha and avijja, as far as I can see, fairly similar kind of synonyms, but we need to see in the canon whether there is a particular place Buddha highlighted. I can't remember, by the way. Go ahead, please.
Great. Thank you. I'd like to invite Sam for the next question. Sam, are you able to unmute? Okay, maybe we can come back to Sam. Kumudini seems to have a question as well.
Yeah, can I? Okay, sorry.
Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Jennifer. Bhante, since it is late, I will make it quick.
Mm-hmm.
While I was listening to the discussion, I did a search on Sutta Central, just for my understanding on Silabhata Paramasa, because I had a great difficulty in understanding that. Because the general translation is attachment to rites and rituals, I found that Bhikkhu Bodhi doesn't really agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
He says the proper translation is the distorted grasping of rules and vows.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's highlighting the word distorted grasping,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to grasping.
Mm-hmm.
A subtle difference between the two, as I can see it.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, like inappropriate grasping or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because one can say, if you're taking precepts, continuously thinking that you are going to get to the goal,
mm-hmm.
That's not going to happen, obviously. So mm-hmm. that can be construed as Silabhata Parama. So is that correct to say that way?
Yeah, I think. Because basically, if we think that totally by observing this particular precept, it will take me to the ultimate happiness, or it
right.
will take me to the complete understanding, it will take me to the complete liberation. So that is taking it too far. I mean, it alone
right.
can't do it.
Right. Thank you, Bhante. So then I also want to share with everyone something that I found. It says that the third fetter is very well explained in a sutta. I'm sure you know about this. It's called Kukkuravatika Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 57.
Uh-huh.
Now, I haven't read it, so I have no idea what that is about.
Right.
So I'm
right.
going to take a look at it.
Uh-huh.
So, Majjhima Nikaya 57.
Okay.
So, that's all I have. Thank you.
Okay. Teruan Sarnai.
Okay, thank you. And sorry, Kumudini, you may now unmute.
Bante, I have a small comment, nothing like a question.
Right.
I was just wanting to further comment on, you know, Chitra Devi was saying about feeling joy for other people's accomplishments.
Yeah.
That is not what I'm referring to when I'm saying that I don't feel elated and, you know, the two extremes I don't feel.
Correct.
It is, yeah. I think she has got that little misunderstand. I feel she has misunderstood what we are feeling. So I just wanted to make that comment one thing.
Don't worry, we understood. Don't worry.
Thank you,
Bhante. Yeah, yeah.
All right, Bhante, I believe that's all of the question on my side. Unless you have any more on your side, then we're all set.
Okay, I think that's all for today then. We have spent almost 1.5 hours, so it's a good discussion. Active participation, and with this we were able to accumulate a lot of merits. So we share these merits with all the beings who are in need of merits. We share these merits with all the past relatives, and we wish these merits help us also to attain path fruition nibbana. So we will recite the traditional verses. Ettavata chamhehi sambatang punya sampadang sambe deva anumodantu sambha sampatti siddhiya. Ettavata chamhehi sambatang punya sampadang sambe bhuta anumodantu sambha sampatti siddhiya. Ettavata chamhehi sambatang punya sampadang sambe satta anumodantu sambha sampatti siddhiya. Akasattha chabummattha devanaga mahiddhika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakkhantu sasanang. Akasattha ca bummattha devanaga mahiddhika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakkhantu desanang. Akasattha ca bummattha devanaga mahiddhika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakkhantu mamparang. Idam vo nyatinang hotu sukita huntu nyatayo. Idam vo nyatinang hotu sukita huntu nyatayo. Idam vo nyatinam hotu sukita huntu nyatayo. Imina punya kammena mame bala samagamo. Satang samagamo hotu yava nibbana pattiya. Imina punya kammena mame bala samagamo. Satang samagamo hotu yava nibbana pattiya. Imina punya kammena mame bala samagamo. Satan samagamo hotu yava nibbana pattiya. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.